You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Well, welcome, everybody, and welcome to the Maggie Dawn Show. And a happy Tuesday afternoon. Hope your work week is going well. So let's start with some of the breaking news, because my head about popped off when I heard this. Apparently, a whistleblower has pointed out the fact that someone presumptively working with our billionaire overlord, also known as Elon Musk, copied some 300 million plus American social security information into a cloud somewhere. This 300 plus million Americans, this is your social security number, your parents' names, birthplace, and of course, your social security number itself. I'm sure nothing to see here. Oh, and by the way, data and cybersecurity experts at the Social Security Administration warned these folks to not do this, that was not a secure way to handle basically the information that lets you get into anybody's bank accounts or credit information. They did it anyways. No big deal. I'm sure that'll be fine. I'm sure there will be outrage from all of the Republicans in Congress. And I'm sure there will be a congressional investigation. No, that's definitely not happening. A little closer to home, the state Republican Party here in Wisconsin just put out a report and concluded that it needs more out-of-state donors. And we need them earlier and basically starting now, according to the Republicans. More out-of-state donors. I'm sure that will lead to less corruption and outside influence. I wish it weren't so, but I'm so glad I've got my good friend in broadcasting, former U.S. Attorney James Santel, joining me this afternoon. There's been so much legal news going on, Jim. It feels like that dominates our news cycles these days. You and I, in preparing for the show, Donald Trump just flat out threatening Federal Reserve Board Governor Lisa Cook. She's one of, I forget exactly how many governors are on the Federal Reserve Board. Happens to be the only black female that was ever on the Fed Board. I'm sure that's just a coinkydink as well. Jim, your react, I mean, he's been sort of working up to this for a while, but it's the same kind of mortgage fraud, vague allegations that the Trump administration officials have leveled against New York Attorney General Letitia James. Your reactions, Jim?
Right. We've got a lot of people, apparently, Maggie, in high places in government engaging in mortgage fraud, including Adam Schiff and Letitia James and now Commissioner Cook as well. And a couple of things about this. Number one, let's all say it out loud. It's illegal, right?
It's illegal, yes.
The Federal Reserve was created, 112 years or so ago as an independent agency. It monitors and obviously sets all sorts of rates and interest rates and those kinds of things, monitoring our federal economy. And for that reason, created by the Congress to keep it independent of politics and independent of the White House, preventing exactly this kind of thing from happening. So number one, he has no authority to do this. He doesn't. And to her good credit, it appears, Maggie, I'm seeing reporting that she's gotten counsel and he is going to file a lawsuit challenging this, which of course would come. And she, along the way, I was hoping she would do this, is apparently refusing to leave. She's saying, nope, I'm not leaving, perhaps physically. I don't know how that works now. Right there off the mall there is where the Federal Reserve is. She is refusing to leave. More importantly, for you, appreciate this much more than I do, on the economy side of things, the notion that you now have instability inside the Federal Reserve, this commissioner now either in or out, sending messages to the international markets, national markets. This is the instability that causes economic crisis. And so in addition to the constitutional problems with it, which are legion, again, it's illegal, can't do it. It also threatens our stability economically, right, my economic friend?
Well, absolutely. And this coming on the heels, I forget which economist just yesterday came out saying 22 of our 50 states, and almost all of these were red states, by the way, are now in an active recession. Mm-hmm. basically bumping up the warnings that we could be entering into a stagflation spiral, warning of recession potentials. Again, stagflation is when you both have high unemployment and high inflation. Those are the two mandates of the Federal Reserve itself, to manage the labor market, to ensure that we have as near to full employment as possible, and to keep inflation low, those dual mandates of the Federal Reserve. And here's the other thing that bugs me so much about this, specifically as to the illegality of this, setting aside the complete and utter ridiculous, unwise economic impacts of this. And that is, they've announced some kind of investigation.
Yes.
Of Governor Cook. That investigation hasn't been completed. There's nothing more than a bare allegation that has yet to be substantiated. And by the way, I don't think this would be all that hard for them to substantiate, right? It's a mortgage document. Right. You go pull the loan application from the bank, not complex. Right. This is just so egregious in that for a mere allegation, no direct evidence at all being shared with the public, an investigation that has barely even begun yet, and it certainly hasn't been concluded, she's being threatened with firing. And good for her for not leaving.
Right, right. And again, this notion, which is also a part of the problem here, you do not announce federal investigations. You don't announce investigations generally. Why?
Period.
I always think, right, about grand jury matters, because number one, you don't want to taint the very investigation that you're pursuing. You don't want people out there to see, gee, I've got to now craft my testimony around what I'm hearing in the media. Second, it also protects the legitimate interests of the target or the subject itself. Many people are investigated all the time. Turns out there's no crime done. There's no offense conduct here. This is problematic in so many ways. And yet it's just once again part of his retribution scheme, right? We don't like people and we go after them. John Bolton, very, very different circumstances last weekend, but the same kind of thing. And again, there we don't know. He may well have engaged in some criminal activity. We don't know about that, but gosh, the very fact that our president has been name-calling, our attorney general and others have been talking about this person as being an enemy of the state once again, it underscores the reason why you don't do that, because now people legitimately can say, gee, there may not be anything there, there could be something there, but this looks like it's politically animated. It undermines once again, Maggie, the integrity of the Justice Department as it pursues legitimate or maybe illegitimate investigations. And that's the message we're sending to America these days.
Folks, it is that part is truly shocking. Let's talk about the Bolton raid, early morning hours on Friday. And then, of course, Jim, we had the Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell transcript. So we had to deal with that on Friday. But John Bolton, former national security advisor in Trump's first administration, he served, I believe, from approximately like April 2018 to September 2019. John Bolton's house was raided on Friday morning. John Bolton may have handled classified information sloppily. I don't know. But here's the interesting part about that. To your point, precisely, Jim, back in Donald Trump's first term, when he was trying to get other agencies in the FBI and then Attorney General Bill Barr to engage in some of this retribution, almost universally, his closest aides in the White House, including White House legal counsel Don McGahn, told him, you can't do this stuff. Because if you do these things and you have publicly targeted or gone after these people, and so they're on your Donald Trump's enemies list, when you do this, then people will have no confidence that there's any sort of legitimate basis for the investigation or the charges. This is from, again, relating to John Bolton's home search on Friday. This is the New York Times reporting. This is what the article says. Quote, from Mr. Trump's first term, he was repeatedly warned by aides, including his White House counsel and chief of staff at the time, that he should refrain from publicly accusing enemies of breaking the law. Among the reason aides told him was that someday, when one of his enemies actually did do something wrong, The public might not believe it because there would be a perception that the accusation stemmed from Mr. Trump's drive for retribution. That's the problem, ladies and gentlemen.
Exactly.
If you want to divide the world into good guys and bad guys and gals, there actually has to be some sort of demarcation, just not this is my political opponent. Jim, do you feel like we are edging ever more closer to complete legal and constitutional relativism, right?
It's absolutely. Absolutely. And it's mayhem. And again, we also think about this based upon what the vice president and the president said in the wake of the Bolton. The vice president talks about how we are now investigating and we are going to pursue this more. No, Mr. Vice President, once again, in a proper administration, you should have nothing to do with this. And interestingly, they're not on the same page because almost in the same hour, my president says, I know nothing about that. Pam is taking care of that.
Right.
Well, even in his attempt to try to embrace something of what he was told in his first term, he gets it wrong. Why? There's also nothing wrong with the Attorney General calling up the President of the United States of America, not to get his advice, his counsel, but simply to say, we want to let you know, Mr. President, that in 2 hours, FBI agents are going to do this. Click. And you hang up, just notifying him, just for information purposes. And the president says, I know nothing about this.
I know nothing about it.
So even in his lies, he gets it wrong in terms of understanding what the relationship should be. This is mayhem. This is constitutional crisis with a capital C and a capital C. And it is plainly, it's so far from anything related to how the process should work. And the reason why your listeners should be so concerned about this is we've got now all these instances, all these people he's going after. That group can well expand, right? And
yes.
At some point, they've got 3.5 more years, depending upon what is out there, that targeted people can be expanded to include you, me, others out there who say things protected by the First Amendment, but that we don't like. And so let's simply go after them, make allegations unfounded, and do things with all kinds of prerogatives that are within the perspective, the possibilities of doing things within the federal government. It's horrifying.
It's horrifying. And as Steve from Milwaukee points out on our text line, how many classified documents did Donald Trump steal?
Right.
The hypocrisy here. Mortgage fraud? Oh, yes. That penthouse in the sky, the gilded penthouse. It's 30,000 square feet or 10,000 square feet. What? Anyways, Jim and I are going to take a breath. You're invited to take a breath as well. When we come back, we're going to talk about a big, big ruling in the Judge Hannah Dugan federal witch hunt. Her motion to dismiss that criminal case against her was decided today. Jim and I will bring you up to speed. So stay with former U.S. Attorney Jim Santel and me, Maggie Dawn, right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. And join us, 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back, everybody, and welcome if you are just joining us. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network, joined by special guest, former U.S. Attorney James Santel. He's with me very frequently on this fine program, and we always appreciate his expertise. We've got a big court decision, folks, that came down today. If you will recall, Judge Hannah Dugan, Milwaukee County Circuit Court Judge, State Judge Hannah Dugan, a few months back did what judges do. She directed people around her courtroom. She managed her calendar. And lo and behold, a month later, Donald Trump decided that she was going to face criminal charges. Well, Judge Dugan, represented by an all-star team of lawyers, including former Solicitor General Paul Clement, a Federalist Society member, very conservative gent, and another former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Wisconsin, Stephen Piskupic, filed a motion to dismiss those criminal charges. And today, federal judge Lynn Edelman issued his decision. Tell us more, Jim.
Sure. So the two motions that, again, the defense counsel raised, first with a magistrate judge and now with Lynn Edelman, number one, that she is immune from prosecution. Interestingly, they said, you know what? If the president is immune from prosecution, we've got the same thing going here. And they also raised a 10th Amendment argument, basically says that this is a state matter. James Madison said the federal government should not be mucking around in state matters, so stay away from that. And the judge today denies both the motion on both of those grounds. Here's one of the things he says, Maggie. He says, there's no basis for granting immunity simply because some of the allegations in the indictment describe conduct that could be considered part of the judge's job. It's a 27-page ruling. He goes on to talk about Nancy Joseph, who's a magistrate judge, who came to the same ruling. And he says, it's true in the bribery prosecutions, concededly valid, where the judges were prosecuted for performing official acts intertwined with bribery. And so dismisses the notion that there is immunity here, also goes on to say, no, this is a matter for federal review. Interestingly, he also says, I recognize that these are maybe not threshold issues of first impression, but he's going to have a hearing on the 3rd of September coming up fairly soon, 11 a.m., and he wants to know whether or not Judge Dugan and her attorneys are going to do what's called an interlocutory appeal. Do you take this up to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals and have them review this before we go on with the trial? My guess is, I suspect it's yours as well, Maggie. Yeah. They will do that. And so that will suspend proceedings for a while. We'll get a decision maybe sometime later this year, more likely even next, on whether or not this is all the case. But again, a big matter coming out of the federal court right here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, just this afternoon. And the case goes on. His attorney's also saying, if we go to trial, we are going to prove that our client, Judge Dugan, not in fact guilty of these federal offenses, including there's an obstruction charge here, right? It's undermining the proper administration of government. And they're quite confident that when the facts are presented, again, the important for your listeners to understand, these are legal issues being presented on the face of the charges. We're not even addressing what exactly happened that day. We're basically saying, as a legal matter, 10th Amendment says no, immunity says no. The judge today says, I disagree.
Maybe.
Let's go to trial.
Yeah. I find it fascinating that he calls out and makes note of the fact that this may be the particular contours here.
Right.
An issue of first impression, which is, frankly, what a federal trial judge does when they're tipping their hand to that interlocutory appeal, Jim, that you mentioned just moments ago. Folks, you can always rely on our legal commentary because we've got a former U.S. attorney and a longtime attorney and myself. We're here to break it down for you. We know those fancy words like interlocutory. It just means an intermediate before the case has finally concluded. Typically, appeals are held until, in a criminal case, you have a jury verdict or a plea or a voluntary dismissal of charges by the prosecution. So I agree. There's no way Judge Dugan's lawyers do not appeal this. They want the Seventh Circuit to hear it. And certainly whomever wins on appeal to the Seventh Circuit will no doubt end up appealing to the Supreme Court. Do you not think so?
Absolutely. And interesting that, again, as you mentioned at the top, Paul Clement, who does an awful lot of litigation arguing
Mr.
before
Supreme Court,
that
yes.
group of nine. And so they may be well familiar with a pleading that comes in under his signature. Wouldn't be surprised. Again, there was another case about a year or so ago involving a judge in the East Coast. The case was ultimately dismissed. But it really is one of these things where you have to get inside the facts and try to figure out what is truly judicial. Are these arguments worth making? And they plainly are worth making. Do they have merit? And it may well be that eventually the Supreme Court, maybe in this coming term, could even decide this major issue of judicial immunity and what the 10th Amendment means in 2025 and 2026.
And here's the thing, okay, folks, if you will remember, this has to deal with ICE agents being in a state courthouse, which has been legally challenged in the past as an improper violation of the 10th Amendment, meaning the agents trying to apprehend someone allegedly here without proper permission, that in and of itself has been challenged legally before. But to keep in mind, that's what this case is about, that person that they were seeking to detain was appearing before Judge Dugan. at the end of the day, here are facts that no one can ever argue about. The ICE agents could have apprehended the man before he appeared in Judge Dugan's courtroom. They chose not to do so. His appearance before her was minutes long, and then the agents apprehended him after he was in her courtroom. Yes, they pursued him throughout the building and outside, but there was an agent with him, following him, and in the elevator with this guy after this hearing. Seems to me to be a very political prosecution.
All trial facts, by the way, right?
Witch hunt. Yes, these will be trial facts. We're going to take a brief break. We've got a special guest coming up for you next. Stick with us. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome, everybody, and welcome back if you're rejoining us. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network while we talk about some politicized law enforcement on the federal level. And I am so excited to be joined by State Representative Clinton Anderson to talk about the politics of law enforcement in this state, specifically how to get communities the number of police officers that we need to keep our families and communities safe. Welcome to the show, Representative. It's a real pleasure to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us what the problem is and how it is impacting our communities as it stands right now. And then we'll get into the solution that you, in a bipartisan, I like to call it now cross-partisan way, are proposing to solve the problem. But what's the problem, sir?
Long-term, we've seen fewer and fewer people signing up to get into the law enforcement profession. For example, I talked to one of the previous Rock County sheriffs, and he said they used to be able to fill a lecture hall with prospective applicants to join the sheriff's department. Now they're struggling to fill a small classroom. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing less people getting involved, and especially in our smaller communities, they don't have the budget flexibility to send folks to the police academy or get the number of applicants they need. So we're seeing a significant shortfall, and people aren't staying in this career as long as they used to either.
Yeah, I certainly know from my time at Milwaukee County, it was a constant challenge to get sufficient recruits for our sheriff's department, as well as specifically corrections officers for our county jail. It was systemic. A little bit later on this afternoon, I'm going to return to a conversation with former U.S. Attorney James Santel, and we're going to talk about the problems that the FBI on the federal level has been experiencing. So the data on this is quite specific. There was a 2024 report from the International Association of Chiefs of Police, obviously a group that's interested in having more police officers, admittedly so. But the data, as far as I can tell in reviewing it, it seems quite compelling that simply the total number of law enforcement officers, whether we're looking nationwide or on a state or community by community basis, is at around the lowest it has been in decades. So what's the proposed solution, State Representative, and who is standing shoulder to shoulder with you to try to get communities the police officers that we need?
Yeah, so we are really trying to focus on smaller police departments, so departments that have less than 25 sworn police officers. And this is a grant program to help them send people to the police academy. So for folks that are listening that may not know, generally our larger departments can pay to send somebody to the police academy. Our smaller departments cannot do that. So they're not only trying to find the small number of people who are at the police academy on their own, they're just not able to send anybody there to begin with. So they're stuck in a downward spiral that's even worse than you're seeing in some of the larger communities. So myself, Representative Donovan, Senator Jesse James, and Senator Brad Paff have all teamed up together to introduce a bipartisan bill to help address that need. And really happy to have the support of every major police group in the state on this.
Yeah, we're actually going to be talking with Representative Donovan tomorrow. I know Bob from way back in the day because we both are from the city of Milwaukee, and yeah. Mr. Donovan was on the Common Council when I was still with the city. The thing that's so challenging here is precisely what you point out, which is this is a major obstacle for the smallest police departments, right? It's not a big issue for Madison or Racine or Milwaukee or Green Bay. those departments are large enough with significant budgets that can afford to send folks to the academy. You all seem to be running into a wee bit of resistance. What this seems to, and listen, we can put a pin in the debate that needs to continue about the trust relationship between community and police, right? We can talk and have a deep conversation about trying to ensure that our officers can maintain their mental health so that they can be of service to the community in the way that they would best want to show up. But those are detailed conversations. There's just a need to have officers in our communities. What seems to be the hangup? Is it the fact that Democrats don't want to talk about this? Is it the partisanship of the thing? What is the political problem?
Sometimes I struggle with that answer too. This proposal would have been $4 million, which in a budget as large as the state's would have been a drop in the bucket to really help, you know, small police departments all over the state. It didn't get in the budget. I'm really disappointed in that, but I'm going to continue fighting. I know the rest of the legislators who signed on will continue to fight for this because we hear it all the time, you know, whether you're Democrat or Republican, you hear that we need to make sure our communities are safe. This is a great way to do that. And personally, I think when you talk about the trust in that community relationship, getting somebody from that community who maybe is unable to get into that department because they don't have the financial means, this could really help us build a better bridge and better community policing practices when you get that small town person to come back to their community and be part of their agency.
Yeah. Again, that problem is more pernicious in smaller communities where incomes are lower. It seems both like classist and elitist. Clinton, I will say this to you, my friend. You come across Democrats who can't figure out that this is something that they should be voting yes on. You send them to me. I'll have them on this show and we'll talk about it. This is one of those things where I think, you know, purity on an issue to the detriment of the thing that you purport, the value that we want, which is safe communities. But the purity test of how that has to get politically or in a partisan way played out gets in the way of things that to me are so common sense. And as you pointed out, Representative, $4 million in a budget the size of Wisconsin? Come on. What? I'm just you're a state representative, you're a Dem, you're in the minority. What is this like when you get to an issue that you're like, well, this should be a no-brainer for everybody, and you run into a brick wall? Tell me what your experience has been like as a state rep.
I would say, you know, I understand that there's a lot of priorities and you can only fund so much, but I feel like this is one, especially for my friends across the aisle, they talk about this as like their top thing, you know, law enforcement, protecting cops, getting more cops on the streets. And now we have a very small expenditure, common sense proposal that everybody seems to agree on. And suddenly we're like, pump the brakes. Let's not put this in the budget. So there are so many times that it's incredibly frustrating. And, you know, I really hope that we can at least get this a public hearing this session to have the conversation, because we introduced it last session. I will say it was later. It was after the budget. So I get it. But we introduced this in plenty of time to put this in the budget and it just got left out.
And again, the folks supporting this, we've got yourself, State Rep Clinton Anderson, a Democrat out of Beloit, State Rep Bob Donovan, Republican out of Greenville, State Senator Jesse James, who's been a guest on this program. Again, a regular guy, a reasonable person trying to do common sense stuff. He's Republican out of Thorpe. Was this the same alignment of legislators that you had the first time you tried to get this passed last session?
Yep, it was us, and then Senator Brad Paff also is one of the Senate authors.
Yes.
So we all did this, put it out last session, put it out again this session, and I'm glad to see so many of our colleagues on both sides of the aisle signed up to, you know, be a co-author of this bill. And, you know, I hope that this, you know, when we see these media hits, I've had a lot more news cameras and, you know, media requests talking about this bill. I'm hoping that brings up enough attention that people say, yeah, maybe we should move on this.
Honestly, send your colleagues my way, because just as a political point, that's a good argument for a Democrat to be able to make. In other words, I can have complicated and interesting and nuanced conversations about this subset of issues related to the police and community relationship. And I can also acknowledge that our small communities, especially in rural communities, need some help making sure they've got the minimum level of officers required to keep their community safe. Let me ask you this, Representative Anderson, and folks, if you're just joining us, we've got Clinton Anderson, the state representative, a Democrat out of Beloit. Let me ask you this, Representative, do you think there are other opportunities? Do you have ideas about legislation? Are there other truly cross-partisan pieces of legislation that you've seen and potentially worked with some of these same colleagues on?
Yeah, and it hasn't been just this topic. I've done some bipartisan work on like artificial intelligence too. So we've seen successes. So I'm not totally gloom and doom on getting things done. It's just that sometimes these ideas just seem like they're such a slam dunk and that we should all just say, sure, you know, even if somebody is saying the system of law enforcement isn't perfect, we do need to make sure we have officers available. If somebody calls 911, they need to be there. And I think the vast majority in this building do agree with that statement.
I yes. And I think the vast majority of Wisconsinites would, right? Like if that was a referenda question, I have no doubt in my mind that the vast majority of Wisconsinites would say, yeah, of course, especially given the relatively small amount of funding. This is one of those like high ROI opportunities. As an economist, that's what I think about. It's like that $4 million in the grand scheme of the budget, literally a drop in the proverbial budget. But the impact of those dollars in these communities, massive. Gee whiz, Democratic or Republican gubernatorial candidates, this would seem to be something of wide appeal. So let's zoom out a little bit further, Representative. This is a difficult time to be in politics. I'm not an elected official, but I talk about it day in, day out. Why do you continue to want to serve your community in this specific way as an elected official?
Well, I mean, I don't know if we have enough time, but I finished college. I got into the nonprofit space, working at a domestic violence shelter, and really had a calling to help people. Simultaneously, while getting my degree, I was on the city council in Beloit. So that's always been my calling, is public service, whether it's in a nonprofit space or in government. So I've just really always enjoyed that. So when I had the opportunity to be in the state legislature, I said, sign me up, I'm ready. And despite the challenges and the rhetoric we're seeing now, I still am very happy to serve. And you know, this is who I am. I'm really happy to do it, and I hope to do it for a while.
Yeah, I wish more of our elected officials reminded themselves of the fact that it is supposed to be in service, not in service of the community, not in service of one's own ambition or ego or seeing your name in big bright lights. Though I'm so happy to have you on this fine program, yeah, talking about this critical piece of legislation. What's number one and two on your major legislative priorities, aside from this bit of legislation, for this next session, sir?
Well, I mean, obviously there's the big broad topics of supporting education, healthcare, but my very focused topics have been artificial intelligence and local government issues. Those are, one is a scary technology, people aren't sure how they feel about it. The other one, I came from local government, I saw the challenges that the state put up when trying to govern at the local level. So that's been something I'm always ready to dig in on and be a policy wonk about.
Well, do you have a little bit of time? Because what I'd like to do, take care of a little bit of business. We got some messages coming up for our fine listeners. And since we both are intense about local government and our love of good local government, can you stick around? Let's talk a little bit about that.
Why not?
Awesome. Folks, why local government is the most important unit of government in your life and what we should all be asking of our elected officials next, with Representative Clinton Anderson, Democrat out of Beloit. Stay tuned, I'm Maggie Dawn, and this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I'm joined this afternoon by Representative Clinton Anderson, a Democrat out of Beloit. He serves in the state legislature. And I discovered last segment that Clinton and I both have a passion for really good and effective local government. Did you have like an aha moment when you were serving on the council for the city of Beloit? Because I think a lot of people have kind of epiphanies from time to time, whether they're a resident and they're calling because the power's now, something's wrong, and they actually can get somebody on the phone and it solves a problem, or someone that joins local government and you look around and you're like, wow, this has an immediate impact on my community.
Yeah, I mean, when I got elected, I was like 22, 23, so I thought I could conquer the world as a city council member. And every time I try to have a big idea, our city manager is like, well, we can't do that because the state law prohibits it. So I just kept hitting those roadblocks again and again. And it also came up to the flexibility to do the spending priorities that our city wants. So last session, we had the shared revenue conversation, but that was a thing that's been a challenge for years. Is, you know, ever since I got in the council in 2017, it was, well, we don't have any extra money to really spend because we don't have state funding and we also can't raise our own revenue.
Yeah, especially in the state of Wisconsin, I've always wanted to be able to talk with people about the importance of local government and these bizarre funding formulas that we have, whether you're talking about the education formulas that are used to fund our local public schools or the local government shared revenue. Man, you need a freaking master's degree to figure that one out and why it doesn't work well. While the state is sitting on, you know, billions in surplus. And the fact, I've always sort of been an impassioned local government advocate, because when it is efficient and when it is effective, again, it delivers the stuff that literally makes our everyday lives better, right? Or worse, relatively speaking, right? How long did you serve on Beloit's council?
I got to serve for 6 years, so it went by pretty quick, but I miss it frequently. Obviously, I love what I do, but, you know, local government has my heart.
Yeah, again, if I call it parks to the pavements, right, to the garbage pickup, like that is the business of local government. And one of the things that, again, I think is so challenging in the state of Wisconsin, because the shared revenue formula is so broken, is that, again, like this problem with police officers that we were talking about in the legislation that you proposed, and the same thing for school systems, the smaller your community, right, the more the funding pain hurts, right? Whether it's police officers or your schools, we're looking at another as the school years get underway. Again, we're going to have how many referenda on the ballots this fall, where school systems are again asking the state and asking their taxpayers to pay more in property tax to fund schools. Was there a particular topic area, Representative, when you were working on the Beloit City Council, where you really were surprised at how local government delivers a particular service or combats a particular challenge in your community?
I mean, learning about the wastewater treatment facility in Beloit was a unique topic. You know, you don't understand all the things that local government does till you're in it and really dive in. But I think a lot of it was the, why can't we just pay to do this project? You know, for example, we had an ice rink that's still in a lot of challenge. Our pools got some challenges financially. And we're like, well, why can't we just put more money into it? And they're like, well, where would you like to pull it from? Because we have no extra money. So the things we all care about, we can't afford.
Yeah, and it's the things we care about, again, that are direct quality of life type things. Like having pools that are public and really inexpensive, and parks in every neighborhood, and some walkable elements of our communities, the school funding, again, all these are all the things. Why do you move into a neighborhood, people? Because of the local government structure, right? You pick it for the quality of the schools or the closest school for your school age child, because it's got beautiful parks or it's a really nice street. That's all local government. And guess what? Democrats and Republicans, everybody wants good schools and beautiful parks and streets where the pavement is upkept, and those capital expenditures Oh my goodness, in community after community, it's such a challenge these days. Every community I know or have any familiarity with in the state of Wisconsin has major capital infrastructure challenges, and there's just, they can't get any more blood from the stone. Let's end on a positive note, Representative. Well, first of all, tell people about your bill one last time, and then give people something to do. We all need something to do to activate us and keep us involved and engaged.
Sure. So the bill is a small agency police grant bill. It would give money to send a person from that small department to the police academy and then pay for their 6 months on the job, which is an incredible hurdle for small communities. If people want to help, they should call and email their state legislators and say, sign on to the bill. And if they are already done that, they should ask to give this bill a public hearing so we can at least move the conversation forward.
Folks, that is State Representative Clinton Anderson, a Democrat out of Beloit, moving forward with a cross-partisan bill that seems to me to be pretty gosh darn commonsensical, and yet they can't get any wind beneath their sails. We're going to be talking about the same topic with former City of Milwaukee Alderman and current State Representative Bob Donovan tomorrow. You're not going to want to miss that. We'll talk a little bit more local government, I'm sure. Clinton, last words, give a shout out to some folks in Beloit if you'd like.
I have to shout out my fiance, Danielle, who's back at school for the second week and is doing really well. She teaches kindergarten. So that's my shout out.
Public service abounds for Clinton Anderson and his girlfriend. Congrats and thank you to all the teachers and public servants out there. Stay tuned. We've got Sarah Anderson coming up next. She is the Institute for Policy Studies Global Economy Project Director. We're going to be talking about the CEO pay gap widening ever more gravely year after year. Stay tuned. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.